Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, welcome tonight. Thanks for coming along to 41 Phillip Street, where Bob Murray makes a welcome first up appearance at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him briefly. He's well known to many of you. Bob Murray, early in his career, was a newspaper journalist in Melbourne, in Sydney and in London. And from 1964 to 1977, he was an industry and political writer for the Australian Financial Review. Bob Murray has been a freelance journalist and independent historian since 1981. He is the author or co-author of more than a dozen books on aspects of Australian history, and has been a prolific contributor with articles on history to such magazines and newspapers as Quadrant, The Australian, The Age, and The Australian Dictionary of Biography. Among Bob's best-known books, I guess, are The Split, Australian Labour in the 50s, which is an enormously important book, and 150 Years of Spring Street, Victorian Government, 1850 to the 21st century. And tonight, Bob Murray's at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the launch of his most recent book, The Making of Australia, A Concise History. And we've asked our author and speaker tonight to talk on the topic, Defending the History of Australia. Bob Murray, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Can you all hear okay?
Yes.
Yeah, well, thanks, Gerard, for those kind words. I'm building this talk as Defending Australian History, as Gerard said, because it needs defending. My book, The Making of Australia, A Concise History, is not meant to be partisan. However, it's intended only as a simple digest of Australian history from 60,000 years ago until the election of the Abbott government last year, in all just over 300 pages. I wrote it because I wanted to and thought I could, and thought it could even be useful. I like to think of it as cutting through the clutter of a huge amount of history written over the last 30 or 40 years. You'll appreciate in doing that, there's not enough room to go into all the many arguments about aspects of our past. Even less can I jam it into this talk. I hope, though, that this approach, simply telling it like it is, or as it seems to me, will help correct many of the more doleful views that abound. Many of you will have noticed that a sour spin on Australian, if not all, history is now common. In this talk, I'll take the liberty of being a bit more opinionated about that than I am in the book. The book covers Menzies, Whitlam, etc., but this evening I'll be concentrating on some more formative times. And prepare for a time machine going. So you prepare for a time machine going back a couple of centuries, long before Menzies, long before any of you or your parents were born. A lot of the underlying discomforts about the colonial nature of our origins. People no longer feel at ease with the British Empire or Commonwealth in the way that would have been normal prior to the 1960s. They find the whole concept of empires to be demeaning and exploitative. Whether it is or was is a very big story. I'm not trying to deal with it here, except to say that until World War I, empire was a common way of governing the whole world and had been for centuries, going back to Rome and ancient China and even earlier. I'll start off with the white side. The convict system was a big success. This is not just my view, but the impression any average observer, I would like to think, would get from the record, such as it is. Some 150,000 convicts were transported to Australia, around 80,000 of them used to New South Wales, which then included Victoria and Queensland. 60,000 went to Tasmania, when it was known as Van Diemen's Land, and 10,000 to Western Australia. About two-thirds were English and most of the others Irish. They were males by a proportion of about 5 to 1. They included 3,000 to 4,000 political prisoners only. They arrived in New South Wales between 1788 and 1840, and close to half that lot were in a busy period between 1825 to 1835. The Vandemonian convicts arrived between 1803 and 1853, but about half in the 1840s, after transportation to eastern mainland ceased. Those to Western Australia arrived between 1850 and 1868, after the gold rush ended, such any deterrent value that Van Diemen's Land still had. With so many involved, it can be misleading to generalise, but I'll have a go. There wasn't much more crime in the so-called thieves' colony than anywhere else, especially if we exclude theft of livestock, which was a bit of a pastime. The process can be described as normalisation, the term used also in the Puritan colonies of America after the first generation establishment period there. The bad press here mainly comes from the small percentage of convicts sentenced to severe punishment for offences committed to Australia. They went to secondary prisons, as they were called, such as Moreton Bay, on the site of the future Brisbane and Macquarie Harbour in Tasmania. These could often be brutal places. The novel For the Term of His Natural Life is a vivid classic of the convict's life when everything went wrong, and it's been a huge seller. The blood and guts sells, I can tell you, that's why I'm poor. Most of the convicts, though, have been pretty petty thieves and brawlers who were sentenced to 7 years transportation, or to more serious ones, to 14 years or life. 7 year sentences amounted to 4 years, as if reasonably behaved. By then, the prisoners were granted a ticket of leave, a form of parole, and could work for wages and do pretty much as they wished within the colony. Most of another year would already have been spent between arrest and trial and being shipped here. Some were unlucky or boisterous enough to be assigned in the colony to road or clearing gangs, but most were sent to work on farms. Sometimes it was hard and dull, but usually healthy work, far from harm's way, and great training to be a future bushworker or farmer. Up to the mid-1820s, on being emancipated, that is freed, they were given a land grant of about 50 acres or 20-odd hectares, which they were meant to turn into as farms to grow food for themselves and for the colony. Some in time established successful farming families. Others, as usually with small farm settlement, gave up or sold out. Any reasonably useful person could get a job once free, usually at better pay than they could expect at home. But many did return home, often working their way on ships. But the picture handed down to us is not all flattering. Though there were many distinguished exceptions, most ex-convicts seem to have been rough, foul-mouthed, drink-loving, quarrelsome men who were nevertheless moderately honest and useful after being freed. Personal improvement was more marked for the women, rough as they often were on arrival. The demand for their hand was enormous in colonies with a preponderance of men. Some were snapped up by soldiers and officials, even in respectable marriages, or by successful ex-convicts. The improved morale helped make them good mothers. Many a London street girl of, say, the 1790s died 50 or 60 years later as a grand old matriarch of a big colonial family. One, for example, had 3,000 descendants when she lied at Wollongong. Sorry, 300 descendants. when she died at Wollongong in the 1860s, and there are now about 10,000 of them, including Kevin Rudd. Writers on the convict years nearly always describe the Australian-born generation as a huge improvement on their parents, usually honest and useful, especially in the bush, if occasionally quarrelsome. What some today would call bogans, what Edinburgh might have called common. But these currency lads and lasses, or natives, as they were called, spoke with a distinctive slightly nasal or colonial accent by the 1820s or so. The shortage of women and prevalence of venereal disease limited family formation by convicts, but one way or another, most seem to have married and had lots of descendants. On some rough estimates, about 20% of Australians today, from families established before 1939, have at least one convict ancestor. New South Wales is on more rough guesstimating at least 30%, and in Tasmania a healthy majority. No names may pack with, I'll look around the room. Federation's another aspect that bothers modern Australians. Many are decidedly grumpy about it. Teachers tell me it's a real bind to teachers. The kids find it boring. They would rather a revolution, or at least verbal flourishes and add-ons about freedom of the American Constitution. They might get some, but I have to say that I think Federation was and has been a great success. White Australia is another perceived cause of shame. I'll offer a little context. It was not too unreasonable for the small, newly independent and united society of 4 million people that Australia was in 1901 to want a cautious immigration policy. was based on economic more than racial grounds, so the two are not easily easily untangled. A little story there, a friend of mine's father worked in the Latrobe Valley in Victoria as a boilermaker, and he tells the story that the workers passed a resolution they weren't going to work with Italians or Tasmanians. that sort of anyway, in 1900 or so, there was a lot of rather cheapish labour around the region by Chinese and Indian so-called coolies, and there was memories of the American Civil War lingered, so it wasn't so very unreasonable. But once adopted, it was not easily undone. Economic slumps and wars in the first half of the 20th century saw to that, followed by the post-war immigration boom. Australia could hardly have promoted dirt-cheap passages in for immigration in, say, India or Pakistan in the way it did in Europe in the 50s and 60s. Nevertheless, white Australia became a hard, unhelpful dogma. It was an embarrassment by the time the Menzies, Holt, Whitlam and Fraser governments gradually entered. I'd leave out the name of Al Grasby there. But not too much righteousness. Australia is still not open slather. The non-white immigrants are still largely limited to those who fit in culturally and economically. The Asian masses don't get a very good welcome. And it was always an immigration restriction policy. Attempts today to present it as being used to oppress Aborigines are simply wrong, though they're common. On the Indigenous side, discussion of today is an early mess, at least of the early Australian history, let alone the later stuff. There's been a lot of good stuff written and screened, and a lot not so good. Goodies versus baddies, cliches, innuendo, undereducated guesstimates, inflated death tolls, acrimonious name-calling, misleading fiction, and defensive dogmas are only some of its troubles. The pious generalities about dispossession and the vague innuendos about maltreatment abound. That's often the worst part of all, and the usual lazy versus left-right barracking. Major questions, especially relating to the disease and health of Aborigines, have been poorly recorded or written about, and after 200 years are still only vaguely understood. We have little knowledge of the numbers of people living in each region in 1788 or now. And a lot of Australians seem frightened of the whole subject. It's just others switch off. Others are very assertive about with very little knowledge. See, in my book, I've integrated it, and it seems to me for the first time, I've integrated the indigenous side of the story into the mainstream white one. I work principally from secondary or more accessible primary sources, but a much more comprehensive book on what's often glibly called dispossession is still badly needed. To start at the beginning, invasion or settlement. One is in black armband or white blindfold country straight away. Neither word is ideal. A colonise is probably best. Settlement's a bit cosy for we whites, but it does get the essential idea that to much of the world, over thousands of years, but not just the British in 1788, the land is meant to be cultivated and to have permanent buildings. There are arguments for invasion, but to most people now it implies a D-Day or Gallipoli landing on a hostile beach. The first Australia Day was just not like that. The Indigenous people didn't know what was happening. One of their grandsons said they thought that weird newcomers must be possums climbing up the ship masts, as some did. They soon worked it out. Then a year or two they became quite friendly with the first fleeters, often visited the little Sydney township, and were quite shrewd about it all. It was not so different in other sites of eventual major towns and cities. The Kulin people of the Melbourne region were well disposed, for example. Indeed, race relations in the first 50 years of the Australian colonies were fairly harmonious. Not always, but fairly. The next 50 years, however, saw quite a lot of violent conflict. The overwhelming impression I get is that fighting, wherever it was usually over property and procedural treatment of blacks by whites. The Aborigines seemed on balance to welcome the whites. He brought the benefits of modernity, but in a wary, apprehensive, prickly, sometimes ambivalent way. They sound like real people to me, including those who worry about the boat people. It could be that the limited white-black conflict in the first 50 years, excluding Tasmania, brought fewer, not more, black deaths. The old tribal ways were often lethal, with death used for punishments and various forms of fighting with other. There were various forms of fighting with other Indigenous groups. This seemed, and there's not much evidence though, to lessen under white influence. the Aborigines had, on balance, the upper hand in those early years when it was needed. Till about 1850, there were few horses in Australia compared to the population now, and white guns were limited to muskets or to cumbersome long-barrel rifles or pistols, all with single shot. The soldiers were mostly on foot until the mid-1820s. Muskets were accurate only for about 50 metres, run unreliable in even damp, let alone wet weather. They required experience to use effectively, all with single shot. The soldiers were mostly on foot. Muskets were accurate for only for about 50 metres... I'm sorry, pardon me, I'll repeat myself. The grazing parties of the war boom that began about 1820 used slow-moving bullet drays to reach their distant stations, with many of the men on foot. The Aborigines had the advantage of knowing their own country intimately, every inch of it, and having in their spears and waddies weapons just as lethal as the squatters' muskets. However, I've never seen any record of Aborigines in southern Australia trying to stop a grazing party from travelling, except for specific reasons, such as alleged interference with women. This contrasts sharply with the so-called foreign Aborigines from outside their own country, who in tribal times would be killed immediately on entering unless they complied with traditional ritual. In the early years, the main events of violent conflict were the Nepean Highway Valley, was an early development for intensive farming in the 1790s and mid-1810s. Then in the Bathurst Mudgee district in 1824, after grazing commenced beyond the Blue Mountains, and in the Hunter Valley a couple of years later. Otherwise, there was not much racial conflict recorded until 1838, by which time grazing had spread over much of the southeast of the continent and the southwestern corner. There was quite a lot between 1838 and 1845, after which there was not much in those areas. Newly independent Queensland experienced quite a lot in the 1860s to 1890s period as the pastoral frontier moved north, and it lingered into the 20th century in the Northern Territory in the far northwest. Tasmania had its own problems, mainly between 1823 and 1830, when farming and grazing spread from the Hobart and Launceston enclaves into the grassy central highlands. This was the period of the so-called Black Wars. In the south of Australia, at least in areas where most people live today, I do not get much impression of a battle for land or freedom. Again, I stress based on the records. There was genuine competition to use the land in the Hawkesbury and the Nepean Valley, and to some extent on the Hunter, but not much in the vastness beyond. It's pretty vast. Elsewhere, racial conflict was usually over property and perceived bad behaviour by whites towards Aborigines, especially over not paying for work done or for misuse of the women. So it hasn't been much changed. The common allegation of white land grabbing is misleading. The government in Sydney granted much of the land nearer Sydney and more so in Tasmania to settlers for a small fee until 1831. After that, the government sold it to raise funds for immigration and what they called internal improvement. The new landholders were what we call infrastructure. The new landholders were meant to both usefully employ convicts and grow food and wool to feed the colony and provide an export. Settlement beyond these limits was illegal, but whites and their livestock flooded in regardless, and squatters, as they were called, had to lease it after 1836. Melbourne, you'll be pleased to know, began life as an illegal settlement of boat people. Generally, except for the very small areas farmed intensively, the land was meant to be shared with the traditional owners or the local Aborigines. Pastoral leases made this explicit after 1848. The official view seemed to be that there was such a vast area of undeveloped or virtually uninhabited land that there was more than enough for everybody. The overall context was not so much the people defending the land, as I say, but them wanting a share of the goods and livestock the newcomers brought. Sheep and cattle stealing, to use a pejorative term in the absence of a neutral one, was the main cause of conflict. There did not seem to be much of it before 1838, after which there was a lot. My impression, for what it's worth, from the record is that Aborigines learnt it from the convicts. The records until then express much more concern about the thieving behaviour of runaway convicts, of whom there were many, than they do about the Aborigines. The Aborigines seemed to love, if not crave, mutton, beef, flour and tea once they got the taste. We must be careful too of talking about the Aborigines as if they were one. They varied a great deal. Some accounts suggest it was more a case to of sheep stealing gangs, black but also sometimes white or mixed gangs, rather than tribal decisions. It was also a handy way for Aborigines to get their own back on squatters who felt they did not play the game. Things on the southern frontier settled down again by about 1840, by the mid-1840s. The Aborigines again integrated their life into that of the stations on their country, learned some English, adopted English-type names and European ways. Whether this should be billed as accepting defeat or sensible modernising is a matter of opinion. I've got none. How big was the Aboriginal population and what happened to it? They had no statistics, so it can only be estimated. Historians today would settle for about 750,000 people in 1788. About 5,000 of these lived in the Sydney region, so there were no traffic jams. By 1933, the number identifying as Aborigines throughout Australia had fallen to 74,000 nationally, after which it started to rising again. However, it's believed that many genetically and culturally mixed people did not officially identify as Aborigines, so the real number on today's definitions probably would have been much larger. Today it's all heading back, the all-up numbers heading back towards that of 1788. Now, the biggest killer was smallpox, which hit in three disastrous epidemics in the 1780s, the 1820s and the 1860s. The first two appear to have been continent-wide and the last confined to the north and the northwest. The first two epidemics of smallpox are estimated to have killed about half the total indigenous population at each time. It's now generally believed that visiting Prepang fishermen from Sulawesi in Indonesia brought the disease. This is another big question, but there's only a remote possibility that the smallpox came from the Sydney settlement, much as many would like to believe otherwise. Areas with a long history of smallpox, such as Britain, Europe and Java, develop a collective resistance, but it can be calamitous in its impact on a greenfield population. Without this resistance, whether Indigenous Australians or Sulawesis in the 1780s, more population decline came from venereal disease. Tribal Aborigines normally lent their women to visitors in exchange for gifts. It was a custom that worked for an isolated population, but it's disastrous when the modern world crashed in. Gonorrhea gums up a woman's reproductive tubes with syphilis, well, syphilis in mothers weakens babies. Anglo-Celtic whites certainly introduced VD, though visiting seamen, whether Indonesian or European or others, added to it. Became disastrously common among the Aborigines and greatly limited their reproduction. The tribal custom of lending wives to visitors must have worked well in isolation, but was disastrous when the world crashed in. Other common diseases such as measles, bronchitis and TB also caused a huge Aboriginal death toll, especially when the white population of the inland increased from the 1830s. They had to learn simple things whites take for granted, such as not wearing wet European clothes, the importance of sanitation when not regularly moving camp. It's not clear how far Aboriginal immunity to disease how far Aboriginal immunity to disease due to genetic isolation was a problem, other than with smallpox. So, but how much can the record be trusted? This is the essence of the rancour in recent decades over history wars, black armbands, etc. But we simply don't know. We've got a fairly good idea that some killings of Aborigines were not reported or that the numbers reported were minimised. But we also know that a vast number of probably fictional or wildly exaggerated stories appeared, spread in later times, about Indigenous massacres. Many still circulate without ever getting it onto the printed page. And I'll just finish up with the famous history wars. They're actually about very little, but they illustrate quite a bit. On one side, Keith Winchell wrote in Quadrant magazine and later spoke out complaining of, for example, an alleged massacre near Bathurst in 1824, where soldiers and graziers, after a shootout, supposedly killed about 100 or more Indigenous people by throwing them over a waterfall. The National Museum presented this as true. Winchell and others have rejected the story as an old-time bush furphy that has no substantiating evidence. The official figure for the Bathurst District in 1924 was 7 whites killed, There is no official figure for Indigenous dead, but 14 has been suggested at the time. But there's a huge amount of these old things that are very hard to prove either way. But there's some sound suspiciously alike and suspiciously fanciful and sufficiently melodramatic. Winstraddle next published the first of a planned three-volume series on the fabrication of Aboriginal history. The third is yet to appear. Is holding it in reserve for the centenary of Gallipoli next year. The first volume was only, I'll repeat, only about Tasmania. He found that the record could substantiate only about 120 to 150 Aborigines being killed by whites in the Black Wars of the 1820s. Henry Reynolds, the historian, had put it at about twice that, allowing for unrecorded killings. Lyndall Ryan and the Aboriginal Tasmanians accepted a similar figure to Reynolds, but speculatively doubled it to account for the rapid decline in Indigenous population at that time. If you follow the book reviews, you'll see the number keeps going up and down all over the time, but usually up. It can only be done by a fair bit of guesstimating. But Winchell examined Ryan's sources, was given in her footnotes, and claimed several of her references were dodgy and didn't support what she said they did. But you can imagine how touchy this ground is for academic historians. Anyway, the storm in a boiling billy can aroused was astonishing, indeed unforgettable. So I hope you'll be a bit forgiving if I step on any toes in this talk. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Well, thanks to Robert Murray, and thanks for finishing on time. So we've got plenty of time for questions and discussion. As I said, there are copies of The Making of Australia, A Concise History, around, and I'm sure Bob would be happy to sign one later. Some of you already got the book, but he'd be happy to sign that later. So we come to questions and discussion. As I said, if I have to repeat the comment, it's because I feel that it's not been picked up by our podcast here. So thanks for your presentation today. It's a long... We don't really have a very adequate, well-written, short history of Australia, and this makes an important contribution. But why do you think among... I mean, as you know, you're a journalist in background, but among the academic fraternity in Australia, that the history, rather than pragmatic, tends to be alienated, and there are not many exceptions to that if you look across the range of those who have contributed to Australian history over the years, like Stuart McIntyre and others who've done both the Cambridge and Oxford histories of Australia. Do you feel that alienation appeals within universities and you don't find it so much in journalism, or is there another explanation? I'm just going to say
That's indeed a big story. I think there's a fair bit of pressure on students towards the blood and guts and black armband side of things. But also, blood and guts is a good story. Now, the kind of story I told is not such a good story. It's black drama, and there's a huge amount of... I mean, the university stuff is not as important. Some of it's just theoretical Marxist stuff where they just deal in very generalities, and Stuart McIntyre does that a bit. A lot of it is very, very sectional about particular aspects. But I think that many of them find difficulty in grasping what colonial history is like. And the sort of thing that got me closer to it was doing some history in the Penrith area years ago, where the descendants of the convicts and the Aborigines all live out there, all know each other, they did in those days, and was real alive, and they wanted their story told, but they sort of just tended to get forgotten in the run of things. And it's too plain Jane. The convicts went out there and one became a member of parliament, and one's first fetus grandson became a member of parliament. The largest ordinary people who melt into the background, they're hardly worth writing about. And the Aborigines, out there, the Western Darug are still there, they've still got their website, every now and again they do something. So it's life sort of goes on. It's almost too normal and too ordinary to be noticed. And university academic historians work from records. They're pretty limited by the records. I think there are a few other reasons, but I'm limited. You have to really be inside a university historical department over many years to really understand the background. People like, I suspect, Henry Reynolds just sees a good story and goes for it. He's a bit like, look around the room, he's a bit like a Frank Clune or a Ian L. Idrius in academic clothing. These are all very long stories. You can pick the black armband, pick stuff to pieces, but a lot of it's just popular stuff. Even novels. Like the one about the Hawkesbury River that Kate Grenville's book about the Hawkesbury River is, to my mind, it's got the white stuff right and the black stuff all quite wrong. But it's a great seller. It's very popular. It's a good novel.
So there's a question here.
Yeah. I was surprised, heard very recently, that when Queensland was declared a state, the majority of the population were German. And I was wondering if the Germans in Queensland were similar to the Germans in South Australia.
I doubt that the majority would have been Germans.
It was
declared a state in 1859. The population was only about 25,000, and they were just a mixed bunch of people who happened to be there at the time. There was quite a big German population there, but it wouldn't be more than about 10% or so, I don't think.
Oh, I see.
And that they were, there's a kind of long stories about who they all were. The South Australians were much more of a dominated by conservative Lutherans. The Queenslanders weren't, and so on. But it's a complicated minority story, and you could go on forever about it. But there was that kind of thing. It was not just disappeared into the population. Like the everybody else.
There's a question here.
Robert, can I ask you a rider to that first question from Gerard, the black armband and the way that we, having two camps, look at our history.
Yeah.
what are the other English-speaking countries like the States, Canada and New Zealand? Do they have the same problem that we have in not being able to clearly articulate our past?
Okay, the question is whether what's been identified as the black armband cultural battle in Australia is reflected in places like Canada, the United States and New Zealand.
Well, I should say, first of all, that American history is a very big subject. I can't claim to know everything that's been written, but my impression would be that there'd be a fair bit of similarity. And up till about the 1960s, it would have been terrific, we're killing these Northern Indians and expanding to the Pacific coast. And after 1960, there was a lot of reflection about that, which resulted in a lot of writing in the opposite direction. And it's tending to settle that way, I think, a certain amount of guilt over what happened to the Indians and Aborigines. It was the Indians and Negroes. It's a much more severe story here. Treatment of the native minorities is quite benign by comparison. It's worth noting that most of the American stories about massacres and Indian fighting relate to the period after the Civil War, when the big plains where you could ride horses and the better guns came about. There weren't in the earlier times when there were only muskets. You hear odd bits about the Indians were more likely to scalp whites than the other way around. But again, it's a huge subject, and I don't claim to have more than a passing knowledge of it. And Canada's full of that sort of stuff too.
And New Zealand?
New Zealand, the Maoris are better organised. They had treaties and things, and it was a more cohesive country, and there were two Maori wars. But they were different. Now, Australia's things sort of didn't have that clear cut situation. They just one merged into another. That's why there were lots of lesser things, and all varied, but no clear cut wars and massacres in the way that there were in America and in New Zealand.
Peter Day,
thanks very much, Bob. Just reverting back to the convict side of it. Probably one of the best-selling books, I imagine, would be Robert Hughes's on Fate of Shore. What's your opinion of that book?
Question about the Fate of Shore.
Very good read, very popular around the world, but not overburdened by accuracy. I said blood and guts cells.
Question here.
The Inga Clendinnen story of the first 3 or 4 years in Sydney, yeah, when the dancing with strangers.
Yeah.
Very appealing.
Yeah. That's pretty accurate and pretty good. Except that then she goes, well, no, we've got to drop the interview. Once Philip was out of the way and the Sydney settlement settled down, then all this terrible stuff happened out in the back blocks. But there were, apart from the stuff on the Hawkesbury, there wasn't much happened. But they always drop in that innuendo about how terrible it became. I saw someone the other day was saying, well, it was okay when Governor Philip was here, but all these other governors mistreated them. But this is a kind of vagueness that goes on all the time, which is simply not true. No governor mistreated any Aborigine. Occasional mistakes. There weren't even many of them. The governors were just doing their best, much like premiers of New South Wales still do. They do their best and they make mistakes and get sacked. And
question here, Fred.
Wondering, could you comment on the decision of Nugget, Coombs and Gorton to give self-determination to the Aboriginal people? I was in Nhulunbuy in 1998, and there were a couple of very ancient Aboriginal elders who were very hostile about the fact that the missions had been disbanded.
Yeah.
Because they were, although they'd been slapped on the hand by the priests and so on, nevertheless, they were very grateful for the education they'd received.
Yeah. Well, I'm not especially
about Nugget Coombs and the aspiration to self-determination.
I'm not especially expert about that. I haven't been in the Northern Territory since I was 18. From what I've heard, the missionaries did a hell of a good job. They're like everybody else, there were good ones and bad ones, and some made mistakes, and they got better over time. They sort of got better at their job, like a lot of other people, and that they did a much. You'll notice that the older Aborigines who went to the mission schools are much better spoken and handle things much better than the young ones. You hear all kinds of stories about the young ones, which are a daily recurrence. Well, I would think that the Coombe stuff is probably quite wrong, but I don't claim any particular expertise about it. And governments thought they had to, always seemed to have to do something about the Aborigines. I think it was Gorton was the other one, but Holt made it. They thought that we must do something, so they started called Coombs in, who was a kind of a banker and literateur, and said, get out and do something. So he sort of did the opposite of what was being done anyway, which is always happens with governments. So not always, but often happens where the things are going on, they go out and do the opposite, and that gets worse. But I have no particular expertise about it. That's my impression.
Yes, down the back, Stuart.
Yeah, Mr. Murray, you said that the squatters participated in illegal land grabs. Did you find it somewhat ironic that having participated in illegal land grabs, that in the late 19th century and early 20th century, that the squatters came to dominate the legislative councils of certainly New South Wales and Victoria?
The question about the squatters and their development.
Well, it's a word that sort of changed its meaning a lot over time and still does. In the early days, there were people who squatted on the unoccupied lands, and it became a thing where the sheep population grew so big and the wool prices were so good that the industry just spilled over the legal borders. The government tried to sort of contain it and couldn't. And they were kept going out looking for feed for their sheep, particularly in the drought of the late 1830s. They went further afield looking for new pastures. A lot of them were just ex-convicts, or battlers. A lot were the sons of the colonial soldiers. A lot were Sydney people, Sydney finance people who sent and from Hobart and Sydney or from London, who sent managers and younger sons out. And they just spread over it, and the government gave in fairly quickly, and they're on licences to it, but they went. It was always meant to be shared with the Aborigines, and the name squatter within a very few years, much long before you mentioned, became rather respectable. The squatters were only rather squatters like for only 4 or 5 years, when they were suddenly the wealthiest and the people in society and the upper houses were controlled by the by the squatters in the later 19th century, because they had the most land. And one Victorian commentator called them the deserving rich, or I'll think of it in a minute. Citizen, it's a sneer about the common people who were suddenly rich. But the upper houses worked by property, and they had the most property. But the name just took on its modern connotations of a well-to-do grazier very, very quickly.
Was the undeserving rich, was it?
The undeserving. What's the opposite? The undeserving rich.
Christine?
I've got a question about the Rum Rebellion. There seems to be two points of view on it. Yeah. The first one is that the rebellion officers were freedom fighters and struggling against the oppression of Governor Bligh. And the Hatchford Abbott view of the history is that Governor Bligh was just a reformer, and he was, trying to break down the monopolists' monopoly at the time, the early 1800s. What's your view on that?
I suppose Kevin Rudd was just a reformer trying to do things, but he did it all the wrong way, and it would annoy everybody and got things wrong. And he fought with the Rum Corps was just people who were, soldiers, in those days it was normal for soldiers to use their position, the officers to use their position, and the lower ranks to make a bit of money on the side. It was normal from armies around the world, and always had been. And they were doing their thing, and they had a run-in with Bligh's. Not the first or last time that the Sydney well-to-do disliked the governor who interfered with things, and Bligh got everybody's nose out of joint. As he did on the mutiny, by the way he behaved. Well, he might have been right, might not be wrong, but he got it wrong. And John MacArthur was the leader of the pack in the Rum Corps, and you have to remember that John MacArthur was a forerunner of Paddy McGuinness, and he sort of didn't like being mucked around with. he was Paddy's great 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 grandfather.
His wife was worse, apparently.
Oh no, his daughter was the best. Was the
Elizabeth MacArthur?
No, he's. It was Bligh's daughter who was the heroine.
But no one ever sent Paddy McGuinness back to Ireland.
It
might have been a good idea.
Notice that Paddy's going to be mucked around with. Well, no forebearer of Paddy was going to be mucked around with.
Well, they were related, were they?
Oh, yes, it was his mother's. His mother was. Come down from one of MacArthur's daughters. So he believes.
I didn't know that. You learn everything at the Sydney Institute. Where do we go from here, as the saying goes?
The families who were established here in the first 20 years tend to be to spread very widely throughout the community through intermarriage and through just marriage.
The ABC is currently running this series by Howard Jacobson, and he's making the point, which is not a point I think that would be unusual to you or to me, but it's unusual to many, that Australia in the 50s and into the 60s was actually quite a vibrant, lively place, that this idea of the Menzies era as being Australia being dull and boring and without culture is pure mythology, because Jacobson said, because he turned up at Sydney University in 1964, that he found it a much more vigorous society than Northern England from where he came, and I think he's also saying parts of London as well. So where do you think this idea has come from, that the Menzies era, which you cover in your book, was this sort of, you don't say this, but the theory that it was sort of, Paul Keating put it around, that it was just Australia in a long-term snooze, a long-term sleep through the 50s and the 60s?
I don't think it was, but I was sort of young and enjoying life at the time, and I just basically don't agree. But and people start to think Menzies has been around too long. He was a bit boring. He's a bit like your father, not your grandfather, still running the show. And they liked colour, a bit of colour and light in governments. And when Menzies went, they got it for better or worse. But that was the government. The things like there was a bit of literary censorship and so on, but it was pretty minor around the world. It was in England at the same time. There was always bits of censorship about what books should be in local libraries. And in Paris, they used to say that Olympic press, you know, wrote the filthiest possible books in English, but they never got into French. Madame de Gaulle wouldn't allow them. It was a bit different, but I don't see it as being particularly worse or particularly boring. I didn't find it so. It's always a grumble, and so is my friend Tony Andrews here, but it was short-term grumbling.
And
I'm just looking at the book. You've got a lot of terrific cartoons from the past. How did you choose them? And did being in newspapers give you sort of the idea?
Question about the cartoons in the book.
I just thought it was a good idea to use cartoons. Where the hell did I get them? It was a trade secret there. I just rattled through lots of books and photocopied and then went after, you know, I didn't go through the newspapers, I just went through other reviews, used ones and found a hell of a lot in the end. And I had to pay for a lot of them, so I just chose the ones that I chose. Now, the best from quite a big selection. I got a lot out of the Australian Encyclopedia and various books written on various subjects. You know, I wish I could have included more, but there wasn't the space and my budget didn't run to it.
There are a lot.
There's still enough.
There's a question here? No, it's not. Okay, so, yes?
Yes, I've always attributed, just out of my head, that the Australian egalitarianism came from the Irish influence. But the other day I came across a theory that it was because the first, 50 years of Australia, the convicts are outnumbering everybody else, so you couldn't be too worse.
It's a question about the source of Australian egalitarianism.
Well, I just think it's sort of... You can't say there's any one source. There's any one. These things happen in various ways. And there was a book come out some years ago talking about the early origins on Australia, Australian American and so on society, and that attributed to the influence of the egalitarian, the Chartist type of movement in the UK, which became much more pronounced here with early British, the first free immigrants. But that sort of would have gone down pretty well in the convict society, which is by instinct sort of fairly egalitarian. And I doubt that the Irish and English were that different about it. Just these things are just, they're kind of broad trends that have various origins.
Now we're getting towards the end, but there's a question here, and then we go here. Hang on, just a minute. Richard? Yeah.
Well, you commented on federation.
Yeah.
I've read recently a number of times that the Australian Constitution is regarded as the best democratic constitution in the world.
Yeah.
With your research into the establishment of the Constitution, would you like to comment on the relative strength that you found in the Australian Constitution versus others like the US?
Well, I think it's a beauty myself, and it's... Those who like it say it's much better than the American Constitution because it was written 100 years later with the benefit of that kind of experience. They also got bits out of the German, and they used a bit out of the Swiss Constitution, and it drew on those things, and it's the best of it. And when you see what's happening in Britain now, where it's all beginning to break up again, and they're wondering how to put the pieces together, you see it doesn't have to have a bad record. And the American Constitution takes sort of a vast amount of court stuff and judicial, and I'm not going to use the word in this company, but judicial activism and so on. And Australian Constitution is much more tightly written that way. And as someone said, it's a book of rules, not a thing which can easily lend a sort of stuff about the Aborigines onto us, like a club book of rules, and very dull reading despite what you hear. But. That would argument wouldn't, if I was to go round some of the pubs in Balmain or Carlton, they would laugh me out of school for saying it was any good. But I don't agree with them. I think it's good.
There's a question here.
What percentage of convicts actually chose to go back?
Oh, no one knows. You find even places of people they went back and they came back because they liked it. one of the ones who did was a convict called John Harris, who was a kind of Eastern European Jew, but he was did it. And they, in those days, parish relief was you had to be in your own parish, you didn't get it, so there was a disproportionate number of the foreigners, you know, and particularly Jews, particularly Irish from London, who were transported because they couldn't get on relief. Well, this John Harris married here, and he went, took his family back, made a bit of money, took his family back, and then they came back. And his great-great-grandson was no other than Richard Casey, Governor General. So, yeah, those sort of things, you can't, there's no record, just only sort of find out on a case-by-case basis. But it happened a bit.
Let's make this the final question. Bert Everett's being mentioned tonight in his work on the Rum Rebellion.
Yeah.
But of course, you're probably best known as a historian for your book on the Labour split, and it's now, I think, next week is the 60th anniversary of Bert Everett's famous book launch down in Castlereagh Street, where he decided it was a good idea to attack the whole branch, the Victorian branch of his party, which set off the great Labour split of the mid-1950s. Through the period you're writing, I think in this early period through the 50s and the 60s, perhaps into the 70s, Bert Everett's a kind of a hero of a lot of academics who are writing Australian history, but he doesn't seem to have lasted all that well. How do you now see Everett's legacy in the view of your work on that period?
I think he was chiefly a hero to people like Gareth Evans, you know, naming names, who like academic lawyers, who like that sort of stuff. And the Labour, you know, the informed Labour people at the time would, they could mouth that he was what a great chap he was, but in private they would say he was a ratbag. You know, like not a ratbag, but had severe failings. And yeah, and I've read recently the view that both he and Rudd were a case of Asperger's syndrome, where they don't understand others' reactions to them. And you know, I don't know whether that's true. That would explain things if nothing else. You know.
In your book, The Split, I think you were the first person in Australia to query Everett's mental state. I think you actually said that he had I think you may have questioned, actually used the word, the question is sanity. That position seems to hold up. I mean, when you wrote it that in 1970, it was a pretty radical position. It seems to hold up better today, doesn't it?
Well, I'd like to think so, but I mean, at the time I thought he was pretty strange, but people were still very, even more so than even now, they don't like to talk too much about mental illness. It's a very difficult thing to talk about. And you don't always know at the time you were on the receiving end, you don't know what to make of it. They couldn't know what to make of it. You know, but he did think, you know, Stan Keon, who was one of the Labour MPs, said he used to ring him when it was all going on in the papers. You know, Rabbit would read the papers at 3 o'clock in the morning and read that Keon's attacking him. So he'd ring him and drag him out of bed and say, "Why are you attacking me?" And I thought I was your friend. And Keon would say, "Because you're attacking me." He said, "No, but I thought you were your friend. It's your head and rear I'm attacking, not you." But that's the kind of thing that was happening all the time. But they found it difficult to talk about. And it was also, if you're a Labour Member of Parliament, that would be sort of disadvantageous to your career to talk about. And they didn't. I think they didn't know what handle to put on it, but they knew he was. But I don't think it was. The only admiration would be from those who wanted to believe in something like that, who liked the idea of the great reforming lawyer and statesman. It was a good front story, but I don't think anyone who was very involved in things believed it, who actually knew what was going on.
Well, can I just say, Robert's book covers from the very early Australia right through the 50s, Menzies and Everett, and right up to the modern times. As I said when introducing the book, there are very few short histories of Australia that explain the country in one volume in a readable way, and it's a very well illustrated book too. It's very well put together. And I said Bob Murray's got some, we've got some copies outside. Janet Grundy's got some copies of The Making of Australia, a Concise History. I'd just like to say thanks to Bob for coming along tonight. I mean, those of us who've written in Labour history over the years, and some of us here tonight, recognise the enormous contribution of Bob Murray's book on The Split, which was actually written essentially from interviewing people and not always with tape recorders, just conversations in the pub and remembering what people had said. And so Bob Murray got people to open up to him and tell him stuff that they hadn't told anyone else, and if he hadn't written it down then, no one would ever have known. So that's an immensely important book on Australian politics and history, and there have been many more since, and the latest one is tonight. So congratulations on the making of Australia, and let's hope it goes well. Well done, Bob. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.